You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Looking to refresh your closet, home, or beauty routine this spring? Walmart's got all the stylish goods in one stop. From chic new looks and the latest makeup to quality furniture and tableware. Go to walmart.com/nowtrending. That's walmart.com/nowtrending for the hottest fashion, home, and beauty finds. Your style at Walmart.
Welcome to the Music to My Ears podcast, brought to you by BBC Music Magazine, the world's best-selling classical music monthly. This week, I'm speaking to the prolific author and Indian classical singer Amit Chowdhury. His latest book, Finding the Raga, an Improvisation on Indian Music, was published recently by Faber, and is part memoir, part essay, centering around his enduring love for Indian classical music and the power of the voice. As well as writing numerous novels, essays, and poetry collections, Amit is a professor of contemporary literature at the University of East Anglia. He spoke to me recently from his home in Calcutta, where he has been teaching remotely. Apologies in advance for a little extra background noise that might be audible in this week's episode. There were dogs, there were doorbells, it was a real glimpse into what life is like recording from home during a pandemic.
So whereabouts are you in the world currently?
I'm at home in Calcutta, in India. And I was teaching in the UK at UEA until early December. Came back and taught the final couple of weeks online because all the teaching was online anyway. And I've been here since. I mean,
so how have you spent lockdown as a writer and a music lover? How have music and writing fit into your experience of lockdown over the past year?
As a writer, I have written about the lockdown. I have, written quite a few essays which are related to the kind of beginning of the lockdown and then what happens later. I've been trying to sort of finish a novel that I'm writing. I corrected the proofs and all of that for the book that's coming out, Finding the Rag. I have a book of poetry coming out in May, so I was kind of putting that together as well. It's called Ramanujan, after the famous mathematician. As a musician, I've been performing. I'll be performing next Sunday online. It's an online performance, but I've also done a kind of actual in-the-flesh performance. And both of these are Indian classical performances, The One to Come and the one that I did. And so I was singing along with my accompanists, tabla player and harmonium player and Tanpura, the drone players. And I hope to return to, performances to do with the other kind of music I do, which is kind of like experimental sort of mix, which I call not fusion. I hope that'll happen. I want to record. I have material that I meant to record. And that's one thing I couldn't do during the pandemic, because we couldn't actually see each other and, you know, rehearse and things like that. That got put on hold.
Tell me a bit about that style of music. You call it not fusion. How would you explain it to someone that hadn't heard it before?
It comes from my sort of background in different kinds of music. It comes from being an Indian who I think being an Indian means being exposed to and it means to internalize an amazing range of cultural references and cultural traditions, you know, so that you don't really know what belongs to your part of the world and what doesn't. A lot of it just seems to belong also in some sense to where you are, you know. So this music that I'm talking about, the experimental kind of departure that began in 2004. I began to work on it in 2004, and then the first performance was in 2005. It comes from me having sort of become a performer in Indian classical music for many years, though I'd grown up listening to Western pop and Western rock music, you know. So until the age of 16, besides my mother's kind of renditions of Tagore songs and some Hindi film music, which would filter through somebody else's balcony or radio or whatever, my main listening was, you know, Jimi Hendrix, The Who, Joni Mitchell, and all of that. And so I began to learn the guitar when I was 13, I think. And I was composing songs by the time I was 15, 16. But at the age of 16, I also became suddenly very interested in Indian classical music, and particularly vocal music, singing. So I gradually began to move away, very gradually, from my ambition of becoming what I've called a Canadian singer-songwriter. Once I made the complete break after I went to England in 1983, I completely stopped listening to Western music. I never thought of it as Western music. I'm saying this because we're talking about contrasting traditions now. So I completely stopped listening to rock and pop, you know. And it seemed like rock, pop, and the kind of folk rock and the experimental stuff that Joni Mitchell was doing, it seemed to have disappeared anyway and had been replaced by stuff that I wasn't that interested in, like Boney M. And then later Duran Duran and Frankie Goes to Hollywood. I mean, I'm sure they're very good, but I wasn't interested in that. And so 1983, I completely cut myself off from that music, and I was just practicing. You know, I was in London, but I was practicing. And Indian classical music, because it needed a lot of practice. And then 16 years later, when I went back to India, came back to Calcutta, I actually began to listen to some of my old record collection again. And I was listening to Jimi Hendrix and, I was listening to a posthumously released collection of his blues kind of guitar playing. And I noticed that the blues is kind of, you know, identical to certain ragas, which are also certain pentatonic ragas, five note ragas. And that the blues also has bent notes, which makes it similar in approach to the note, similar to Indian classical or Indian music. So I was listening to all of that, and then something must have kind of changed my mindset and alerted me in a different way to my own memories, but my own past. But, you know, one morning I was singing Rag Tori, and I sang a phrase, and I thought I heard the riff to Layla, Derek and the Dominoes, in the phrase that I was singing. So I finished singing Rag Tori, which I was practicing in the morning, singing rag, a morning rag called Tori, and I said to my wife, you know, I just heard Layla in this particular phrase, the riff to Layla. Do you think that I could do something with this musically in terms of a composition? And she said, yeah, well, you know, go for it. And that's how it began. And two weeks later, I was in a hotel lobby, and there was this instrument I could hear this instrument in the lobby called the santoor, a Kashmiri kind of instrument. And it was playing, again, a pentatonic rag called Bhupali, but at at one moment it seemed to launch into Auld Lang Syne, you know. And again, that was because of Auld Lang Syne being based on this folk pentatonic, a major pentatonic, which is what Rag Bhupali is as well. So once these convergences began to occur, I began to play around with the idea of creating a musical idiom with which to explore and improvise around them, to create a kind of compositional structure in which the convergences could, these notes and traditions could refresh one another and could be improvised with, could be played around with. So that's how it happened. It became a series of different kinds of experiments where I was often playing around with found material. So it wasn't just this kind of stuff, but it basically became an experiment in dealing with material that already existed in some form, whether that was the Riff to Leela or Raag Tori, or, you know, the train sounds made by a train in the Berlin Underground. You know, everything became musical, you know, and a kind of starting point in exploring something musically. Yeah.
So when you first transitioned from your love of Jimi Hendrix to a rediscovery of Indian classical music, what was it that drew you back into those sounds from your native India?
Well, Indian classical music, like European classical music, isn't something that, I mean, classical traditions are often sort of minority tastes although I came from a very musical family, it's not as if I grew up with Indian classical music. So it wasn't a rediscovery, it was a discovery. So, I mean, it's just as for most English people, I mean, Benjamin Britten or Mozart would be, you know, discoveries at a certain point of age, unless they grew up in a family of classical musicians. And even that wouldn't be a guarantee. I mean, as a child, you might kind of not listen to that stuff at all. So for me, it was very much a discovery. And the discovery happened. I began to hear snatches of song or performances. And I must have been open-minded enough at the age of 16 to actually notice the beauty of what I was overhearing, because, you know, classical music, because it's difficult in any tradition, you know, there's a prejudice against it, and, you know, it's not easy to listen to for a lay listener. So the lay listener might think, well, what is this, you know, what's going on over here, whether it's opera or whether it's khayal, you know, and a moment needs to come in your life when you begin to suddenly open up as a person to things which are not so much your own as we think classical traditions are, but which are inherently strange and foreign, which is also what classical traditions are. And I let myself be touched by that strangeness. And that happened because I would see somebody being interviewed on television. The interview would be in a language like Marathi, which I didn't actually properly understand. The Indian languages that I spoke were my mother tongue, Bengali and Hindi. So I wouldn't understand what was going on, but then I would suddenly hear the singer sing something extraordinarily beautiful, but also difficult to do because I would then try to replicate it. Remember, I was a singer, I was singing with the guitar and all of that. So, and then also my mother's teacher, she was a singer of Tagore songs, but also of devotional Hindi songs. And a new teacher began to come to the house to teach her Hindi devotional songs. His name was Pandit Govind Prasad Jaipurwale, and he died at the age of 44 in 1988. So I'm talking about 10 years earlier, in 1978, when I was 16 years old. He began to teach my mother, and he was an amazing classical singer. Besides being a singer of devotional songs, and this the Urdu love song called the Ghazal. He was an amazingly accomplished and gifted classical singer whose father was a great, great singer, Lakshman Prasad Jaipurwala, but who was also the composer of these extremely complicated, complex compositions, you know. And those were the compositions that I began to learn from Govind Prasad Jaipurwala, because, again, this face-to-face kind of encounter with a man whom I could listen to in our house, doing these tiny modulations with the voice, singing the same phrase twice, but with subtle alterations, and creating beauty, I suddenly thought, this is amazing. I want to be able to do this. It speaks to me. And after that came the period of listening and discovering, just as I said, 16 years later, I suddenly began to hear the riff to Leila or Auld Lang Syne in ragas. This is because an inner alertness then begins to make you pick up things and sounds and listen to them in a different way without you necessarily seeking to listen differently. But this is what would have happened to me in 1978, that I suddenly became attuned to listening to classical music, to discovering it, attuned to discovery, you know. And so I began to listen to these radio stations, All India Radio, which I had never listened to before, in the spirit of discovery, which goes far deeper than any kind of scholarly research, because it's so deeply self-interested in an artistic and creative sense. And then tuning into listening to channels on TV, which were completely entirely devoted to Marathi language fare, and things that I had no interest in, you know, I mean, this Marathi language kind of stuff, because I didn't understand the language. And then suddenly to find somebody singing something and to be struck by it, to be electrified by it. And all of that coming without any system in place, any star system in place, telling me that, guys, you know, we are listening to this. You must listen to this. I mean, as would be the case with, you know, to a certain extent, listening to Jimi Hendrix, you know. So there wasn't any of that context. My friends were still listening to Jimi Hendrix or whoever came, you know, whoever they were interested in later. So this was a genuinely solitary discovery, coming without any kind of star endorsement. Not to say that some of these people or a lot of them weren't stars in their own worlds, but you know, that's how it happened.
Mm. Are there any artists or specific pieces of music or moments that you recall hearing and falling in love with as your first introduction into that world of Indian classical music?
Yeah, I do. Kishori Amonkar, this great singer, this woman, who is possibly the greatest singer of classical singer of a generation. She died some years ago. Listening to her, she is one of the people I mentioned watching and listening on this Marathi program on Sunday mornings that happened on Sunday mornings on television. Not quite understanding what she was saying. Of course, there are similarities between Marathi and Hindi and Bengali. Trying to follow what she was saying. Then suddenly she stops speaking and she demonstrates something and sings. And being struck by the tone of her voice and how much she could achieve in those few minutes with what she was doing with those notes. 2 weeks later, so this happened fast, a singer called Bhimsen Joshi on the same program. So I must have thought that, okay, this program is interesting. I better tune in on Sunday morning and listen to what's going on. So there was Bhimsen Joshi, and again, he sang a little bit of a tumri, which is a romantic, it's called a semi-classical form. It's a romantic form, which usually expresses or narrates something to do with the love that Radha has for Krishna, the god Krishna. So he sang a few lines from a tumri. Again, I was very, very struck by just the beauty of the modulations. And And of course, the modulations were very fluid. So I knew that they weren't, you know, they weren't set in stone, that they were being created on the basis of the rag and the basis of the form at that moment, that if he sang it another day, it would be slightly different. Then there were the recordings of a singer called Bishwadev Chatterjee, who was very well known in Bengal at one time, but isn't that well known outside it, a remarkable singer, classical singer. So I was listening to his 78 RPM recordings, so that he sings the kind of, as many classical singers did, he shows us the gamut of what's possible in an exposition in 3 minutes. So what a singer could take 30 minutes to 1 hour over. I mean, they do over 3 minutes. So a singer called S.D. Burman, better known later as what's called a music director, a composer for Hindi films. But he began as a singer of Bengali songs, but Bengali songs which were deeply rag pradhan was the name for that genre, or raga dominant. So a lot of improvisation going on in those songs. So I think what I was interested in was tone of voice and beauty of invention, you know, that particular kind of music made possible.
And in your new book, Finding the Rag, you mention your first interactions with Indian classical music, but also, for lack of a better term, Western classical music. And you talk about when you first came across the Beethoven symphonies conducted by Karajan. Can you tell me a little bit about how you came across that and how that has kind of intersected with your listening and performance of Indian classical music?
Sure. I was listening to that around the time when I was discovering Indian classical music, North Indian classical, Hindustani classical music. My father had what would today be called maybe a box set, if that term applies to vinyl records, you know, but it was in a big box, you know. So he had this stored away. It's not that he listened to it. He must have bought it out of a sense of duty or curiosity at some point. Not that he was closed-minded, but, you know, it just wasn't part of our listening. But I'm glad he bought von Karajan. I mean, of course, I mean, he was a seminal and important conductor, but still, it could have been some other conductor. I'm glad it was him, because I grew very attached to those versions. And sometimes I found it difficult to feel attached to, when I began to listen again, to other versions of the symphonies that are conducted by others. So when Beethoven, you know, the pastoral or other symphonies are, when I think of them, it's his versions that I think of. So I was listening to them. I was leading this weird life. I mean, I was listening, doing music, trying to kind of write interestingly, become a world famous poet at some point, be a Canadian singer-songwriter, was no longer interacting with people, had stopped going to college, spending more and more time by myself, except for my parents and my music teacher's family. So all my contemporaries that kind of were fading away from my life. I was leading a peculiar life. and so, you know, I was planning gradually to depart from what is basically a sociable form, performance, performing Western pop, going out, playing with the guitar, receding more and more from that into the solitariness of riyaz or practicing Indian classical music. So I'd gone down that path, but at the same time, I was listening to Karajan, Beethoven. And I was listening to Beethoven, I think, when I would listen to Beethoven, I mean, I'd listened to some of the symphonies repeatedly. Symphony six, number six was one of them, a pastoral. And then I would listen to seven. Seven was my favorite. I thought this was an amazing work. So I would keep listening to it. A pastoral was lovely, but it was too pleasant and sweet for me to completely love it, you know. But I noticed then that I was creating narratives in my head when I was listening. And maybe that's because of the way one had been instructed to listen, even if the instruction hadn't come to you in so many words from books or from an instructor, but the instruction had come to one from cinema, maybe. So cinema had seen to it that one associated music and even classical music in the West with certain kinds of atmosphere and narratives. That a sad moment would have a particular kind of music playing in the background. Happy moments would have a different kind of music. Terror would have yet another kind of music playing in the background. So that was instruction. You know, we'd been encouraged to listen and think of at least Western music, and because one was still in the world of Western music, to think of music in that way, happy or sad, and sometimes terrifying. And then if it was not immediately comprehensible, as might be the case with atonal music, then, you know, associated in the mind with either the destruction of something, the destruction of form, or personality, or trauma, or something, or if it was movies, terror, definitely, atonality would lend itself to that kind of mood. So I was listening to Beethoven and creating these narratives in my head, and then I began to think as well, because maybe by then I was also thinking about what Indian classical music was all about. I was thinking to myself, why am I constructing these narratives? You know, what's going on over here? Of course, it's the most natural thing to do. And people talk about music in this way. Beethoven is, you know, Beethoven exemplifies the struggle of the soul with something. You know, it's the way we've been taught to think through biography, through literary criticism. It's not just music. It's everything, you know. We think allegorically almost. So, but the exposure to Indian classical music and Indian art as well, to a certain extent, was making me qualify the allegorical kind of response and making me look at it from a slight distance. Maybe I wouldn't have had that distance at that point if I hadn't begun to listen to Indian classical music, and through Indian classical music begin to discover Indian lyrics, Indian poetry from a certain age. And also then through that begin to look with more interest at Indian miniatures, Indian art, Indian dance, and see what all these things were up to, you know. So because all of that was happening, I began to see things less in terms of man's kind of drama, this drama of man's soul, you know, I began to see it less in terms of that. That's how that happened. Yeah.
It sounds like you view narrative as intrinsically linked to both kind of European music in the Pastoral Symphony, for example, and also in the Indian Rag, in terms of, you talk about in the book about the exposition of a narrative and how that kind of reflects. Could you tell me a little bit more about how the arc of a narrative can be seen as similar to that of an Indian rag?
But it would be a very different kind of narrative.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be a narrative about necessarily clearly demarcated moods, where the clearly demarcated moods are denoted by a set of notes which we traditionally associate with those moods, such as, a fast, cheerful movement in the major scale in the pastoral kind of being associated with the spring, minus the minor scale, a sort of being sort of the way of representing a storm, you know. It's a very different kind of narrative. It shows that narrative development is possible without the sense of, developing in the way we think of development as the person was born, they grew up, they had their ups and downs, then they triumphed or they didn't triumph. These were the moments of triumph. These were the moments of defeat. These were the moments of happiness. These were the moments of sadness. And then it all comes to an end. It's not that kind of narrative. That novelistic narrative is not the kind of narrative that I'm talking about. It's a narrative in which there's a modulation on themes leading to constant surprise. The development has to do with the surprise of one thing being turned to another through tiny modulations, which we call improvisation, but which are intrinsic to the development of the rag. So the fact that these notes can then be approached in the next moment in that way, while maintaining the requirements of the rag to not depart from a particular sequence or arrangement or relationship of notes that is kind of intrinsic to that rag, while maintaining that, yet you look at that particular relationship as you progress from the lower octave to the upper octave in a multiplicity of ways, each one of which is surprising and unexpected. It's that kind of narrative. So when it's that kind of narrative, then you don't say, well, this bit is more important than that bit. You don't say that, you know, the moment of struggle is deeper than the moment of happiness. The happiness bit is a filler, which is leading to the crisis. You don't think of it in those terms. Each moment is a moment of surprise and a renovation of perception of what is happening to those notes. So you have to find a different way of thinking about narrative when you're thinking of narrative in that way.
And on a purely practical basis for you as a writer, because you've written hugely prolifically, do you listen to music while you write, or do those entities have to be very separate for you?
I generally don't listen to music when I write, and I generally don't write when I play music, when I sing. You know, I mean, they are such acts of attention and absorption that you know, that's not to say that I'm one of those people who kind of wants a complete vacuum around me in terms of sound. That I find inimical to creativity. I need sound around me, both as a musician and as a writer. Which is why sometimes I find life in Europe, in a suburb in England difficult, you know, because of the silence. So I need that. I need that constant flow of life, and which I identify with sound, actually. And that life is unseen. So life is not only what's visible, but what you can't see around you and what you can hear. So I identify depend on that flow of life, of invisible life being there around me and coming to me subtly through sound. But music is such a powerful thing for me that it can never be background, especially Indian classical music. I think no listener, if they have begun to sort of enter that world of Indian classical music, could ever treat it as background, not even for cooking. You know, if you've entered it, you will stop to listen to that modulation. You will stop to listen to the fact that he or she did something there which they changed subtly over there. And what was that? So you will then stop, you know, chopping the onions or, you know, whatever it is you were doing with the spatula at that point of time. So you know, I don't listen to music when I'm writing.
No. So where does it fit into your day, and how do you decide? Because obviously you've mentioned the wide range of musical interests you have, Indian classical music being just one of them. How do they fit into your day, and how do you choose which genre to pursue?
Indian classical music is the training that I undertook, the kind of singing that I do, is now and has been for the last 30 years fundamental to me in terms of how I perform and improvise. So whether I'm performing quasi-jazz, fusion, vocals with through the rag, or whether I'm actually singing Indian classical, North Indian classical music, I have to keep practicing. But I can't do those improvisations without practicing. So my week, my day, my life is organized around sessions of practice. So I practice through the week, sometimes even 4 hours a day. That'll happen twice a week, sometimes 2 hours, sometimes 1.5 hours. And there will be days when I don't practice to rest my voice. And those days are like, you know, like amazing opportunities to to just relax. But then I have to catch up with other things during those days. But the days when I practice for 4 hours, I can't do anything else. The other days I kind of work on the music practice, but also write. In the evenings, I don't do anything. I try not to do anything.
Wise. Fab. So you mentioned practice there, and you kind of draw on it quite a lot in your book about your experience of practice. How does practice and the discipline of music play? It seems to play quite an integral role in Indian classical music. You impress upon that quite heavily throughout the book. Why is it such a form that requires such practice?
I think any classical music requires practice, right? I mean, European classical musicians, I mean, that's one of the things that they have to keep doing, practice. Because otherwise you can't do the things you want to do with facility. It's like sport. I mean, it's being in a state of preparedness, but also like sport, I mean, it's physical. So as you grow older, you know, maybe things slow down. Certainly they do. Parts of the voice may not respond in the way that they did when you were 30 years old, you know. So it might be a little bit this whole business of singing, improvising as a classical musician at the top of your powers. It might be a bit like inspiration. You know, poets have their kind of periods of inspiration. For some of them, the inspiration ends when they're quite young. So even this, I mean, to prolong the shelf life, yeah, you have to keep practicing. But even that cannot kind of delay the onset of age, the effects of aging.
And as a listener, this podcast is a lot about the music that you listen to. Mm. Are there any pieces of music that you kind of can't live without and that you return to time and time again for whatever reason they might be?
Some of the people I mentioned earlier, there's a lot of Indian classical music that I mentioned in the book. There's one particular kind of section where I just mentioned all the people that I, you know, just listened to and was kind of, you know, changed by, transformed by. And I still listen to them. And I could not live without listening to them. YouTube has also kind of made it possible to listen to stuff by them which I never had access to before, which is remarkable. That's wonderful. There's also Joni Mitchell, you know. Sweet Baby James by James Taylor. Keith Jarrett's The Cologne Concert. some of Beethoven's piano sonatas, and you know, I would be, it would be pity if I couldn't listen to them again. It's an eclectic kind of very various sort of field of music that I take sustenance from.
I have to ask you as well about Ravi Shankar, because I know I wrote your beautiful tribute that you wrote about him just after he died in 2012. Can you tell me a little bit about your experiences of working on his opera with him?
Well, when I started working, finally started working on his opera, he had died. So I would have worked with him because, you know, that was supposed to happen, working with him, but it didn't happen. So I worked with, you know, the group of people that, you know, dealing with his music, primarily somebody called David Murphy, who's a conductor and composer and who was intimate with Ravi Shankar's work and the work he was doing on the opera. But, you know, artists like Ravi Shankar, I admire a lot because, I mean, he's one of those people who kept the level high right till the end, did not take, whatever we might think about him, did not take his huge celebrity for granted, did not let go of the essential discipline and demands of being a musician, which it is easy to do once you become a celebrated figure in the way he was. But he didn't do that. So he's admirable in many ways.
And before I let you go, thank you so much for your time. I just want to ask you one final thing, which is, what is your current musical obsession? What are you thinking about or trying to work on as a performer? Or what are you listening to? Anything like that?
So I said, excuse me, I want to record some new material that's been sort of gathering dust for this experiment that I was discussing earlier. I want to release some of those songs that I naively sang and composed as a young Canadian singer-songwriter at the end of the 70s. That I'll do soon. I revisit a lot of older things that I listen to. I listen to my daughter. She's a wonderful singer, Aruna.
That was Amit Chowdhury talking to me from his home in Calcutta. We hope you've enjoyed this podcast from the team at BBC Music Magazine. Do let us know what you think of the podcast by rating and reviewing it wherever you've been listening. If you want to find out more about BBC Music Magazine, we're available in print and various digital formats across the world. Or you can visit our website, classical-music.com, where you can read about all the latest music happenings, read thousands of reviews and a good deal more. Thank you to Acast for hosting and Brittany Colley for producing.